Good evening, everyone. This is host Terry Lynn Coop with the Blue Plate Special, and I am just thrilled tonight to be welcoming Tess Gerritsen to our show. International best-selling author Tess Gerritsen took an unusual route to her writing career. First, she started at Stanford University and then went on to med school at UC San Francisco. While on maternity leave is when she started writing her first books, but the books that we know are best for, her medical thrillers, started in 1996, with the release of Harvest. And since then, it's just been history. And if I stayed here and went through all of her credits, I'd be saying goodnight to everyone. So I'd like to welcome you. Welcome to the show, Tess.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Let's start right out with your new book. Why don't you tell me a little about it?
Yeah, I Know a Secret is the 12th book in the Rizzoli and Isles series, starring homicide detective Jane Rizzoli and medical examiner Maura Isles. And it opens up with a really chilling crime scene. There's a young woman who looks like she's sleeping in bed, except that she's holding her eyeballs in her hands. So they know she's definitely
dead.
That's
so awkward. That's so awkward.
I know, it's so awkward. And they think they're dealing with just some weirdo, some crazy person. But then not too much later, they find another crime scene and this young man who's dead on a pier with arrows stuck in his chest. And the one thing that connects these two murders is that Maura Isles cannot figure out how they died. They clearly have been murdered, but she can't figure out how the murders were done. And that sets off this whole series of twists and turns that lead them through some various theories.
And that's fascinating, and that's a perfect spot to head into what I think is the crux of our talk tonight. You know, you talk about these two obviously very gruesome murder scenes where, you know, one, she's had her, and dang it, I cannot remember the technical term for having your eyeballs removed, and the other one, you know, he's pierced with arrows, but they can't figure out how they died. I mean, that obviously is going to get deeply into your medical training. How do you put medicine into it?
It's, you know, that is really a matter of, I think, almost being an interpreter for the layperson. A lot of stuff about medicine or about science in general has its own language, and the language is indecipherable to those who are not in the in-group knowing what this means.
Yes.
So I feel as an author, I need to explain things and to open up this, you know, open the door to a world that most people aren't really privy to.
So I assume you go through and they autopsy the victims, et cetera, and it just remains a mystery how they were actually killed aside from the mutilation.
Right, it is. And this is where the role of Jane Rizzoli comes in. So Maura Isles is my pathologist, and she is going to be talking techno-speak. Jane Rizzoli is the every woman who wants to have things explained. And in a sense, she's sort of in the footsteps of the reader. What does this mean? How do you know? What are you looking at? What is this lab value? What does it signify? So in explaining to Jane what these things mean, Maura is also explaining to the reader. And I hope readers learn something about autopsies and about how doctors think. So, in the autopsy, we do discover some things. We find out that there's really no obvious way that these people died. And in exploring the possibilities of how you kill somebody without leaving a trace, I go into medicine. I also go a little bit into the history of crime and how these murders might have been happened before.
That is absolutely fascinating. And during your medical career, did you run across cases like that where it's like, why is this person dead? Or why is this person sick or hurting?
Well, you know, okay, I saw people who were alive. My medical experience was as an internal medicine doctor. So I was seeing living
people.
And yeah, right. So the mysteries we often had were, why are they sick? What's making them have these symptoms? So it was never like, why did they die? We usually knew by the time they died what was wrong with them. Medicine is full of mysteries. And even today, I think some of the most interesting articles you'll find in the New York Times Magazine, for instance, is this bizarre set of circumstances and symptoms and what is wrong with the patient. And the problem is sometimes the answers are, they come to you later on. They come to you after the person is long dead, or they come to you with the advance of medical science, and you learn more about the latest bacteria or the latest parasites. So the answers are usually apparent, but sometimes you just really don't know.
And I like how you said that, where you talk about you have your, obviously you have the pathologist character, and then you use the detective as an interpreter.
Yes.
That's actually fascinating.
Because if I were to have two doctor characters talking to each other in medical speak, they would talk in unintelligible terms. It would be really difficult for the reader to understand. And I'd have to put glossaries underneath everything. Sometimes you have to do that. You have to put a glossary, or you have to put footnotes. And it makes it harder to read.
Well, I've always enjoyed your books, and I definitely do learn something, and it never feels unintelligible to me.
Well, you know, I think one of the ways I use to make medical terminology more understandable is I don't stop to explain, but I give everything an emotional value. So if you hear a nurse say, "Oh my God, he's in VTAC," you don't know what VTAC is, but you know it must be something really bad.
Gotcha.
Based on how the characters are using the term, what their emotional reactions are, and how everybody suddenly rushes around panicked. So you don't really have to define what ventricular tachycardia is. You just need to know that it's an emergency and everybody has to jump on the problem immediately.
So, and that one, like you said, emotional value, context, et cetera. And I do some similar things. I'm writing some scenes right now that have some engineering to it, because my first degree is in engineering, and that's the same thing. It's like I have to try and make mass spectrometry interesting.
Uh huh.
And the same thing. I don't go into how it works and how you read the graph that comes out of it. I just come back and said, you know what? The mass spectrometer says that's hair cream.
Yeah. Yeah, right.
And
you have two characters just bending over and looking at the reading and go, "Oh my God, that's unexpected," or having, as long as they have some emotional reaction to it, your reader immediately cues in on, "Oh, this is an important detail. Let me pay attention." So it's really, I think, even with cold scientific facts, we still pay attention to the emotional reactions of the characters to what the fact means.
And again, that's interesting hearing that from you, because like I said, I've read tons of your books and everything, and I've always found them very accessible without really knowing why. And now you're showing me the blueprints of the house, of what's behind the walls. And that's great, and it's really important, because I'm a lawyer by training, and as we were talking in the green room, when law is done properly, it's actually boring as all get out. And how do you make it interesting and exciting? Obviously, things go wrong, but you have to make it feel authentic with something that would actually just horrify a lawyer in real life. You have to make it exciting for them.
Yeah. Well, you know, I once had to describe the process of doing a spacewalk. And it's really kind of a boring engineering thing. You do this, you do that, mm-hmm. you do this, you do that. But the way I made it more interesting was my character is thinking of all the consequences of when things go wrong. And essentially she's thinking, I could die out there, doing my spacewalk, and this is what it would feel like to die. What does it feel like to die with decompression? And so it suddenly becomes every single thing that she does, every checklist that she she goes through, you realize this, everything is so important, because you can die a really horrible death. And I think that makes the checklist much more interesting, knowing that if you skip a step, there's a bad consequence to that.
They mean it when they say put the switch over to the blue mark. They really do mean
that. They really do.
For a reason. Well, and even on that, when you were talking about the spacewalk, I was thinking back to one of James Michener's books, actually, his book Space, and he had two pilots talking about high-performance aircraft. And the same thing, that could have just devolved into being as boring as all get out. But how they started talking about is how the seat felt under your butt. And you could tell when the plane was starting to slide because he said you feel it through the seat. And it was absolutely fascinating to listen to it. And suddenly you had this, you know, you had this sensation that you were flying in this high performance aircraft, and sensing everything that was going around you. So that was kind of what I felt on the spacewalk, you know, the spacewalk scene is it puts you in it and just how it feels.
And on also being really, really aware of if you don't do it right, this is how you're going to die. Just every little details that seem trivial end up being really life threatening.
They mean it. Yeah, they didn't make that checklist up just for fun. They actually do mean it. And a friend of mine. Go ahead.
Well, a friend of mine, anybody.
Sorry, we have a slight lag on the cell phone. So please complete your thought.
Oh, the only thought I was thinking was that, you know, I think science can be so exciting. And I was thinking about the book The Martian, which has a lot of science, a lot of chemistry in it that could be incredibly boring, except that everything he does is so vital to his survival on Mars. And that's what made that book work so well.
Absolutely. That is a perfect example. A friend of mine, a literary agent, she was talking about what she looks for in books. You know, and she said she's not a scientist, a lawyer, a doctor, or anything like that. But what she called it was the tang of authenticity.
Mm-hmm.
And even if you do something that might be a little bit outrageous for your having your professional do, if you convince her that it's authentic, she'll go with you in the story. She'll believe you.
That's true. And the other thing that's important is language. I think having your characters talk the way they would as scientists is really important. When I have my doctors talk, I don't have two doctors talking to each other and saying, oh, Mrs. Jones had a heart attack. They just wouldn't say that. They say she had an MI. Yeah. And even though it is lingo, it has that feeling that you're listening to two professionals. So I think it's really important to get the language down when your characters have a specialized occupation.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's the same thing, whether they're two cops talking together, whether they're two military guys, two lawyers. And again, a lot of fans of your books anyway are probably going to be fans of shows like ER.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and other medical
yeah.
shows. So we've been exposed to some of it.
Yeah, they know the lingo. They know what stat means, and they probably know what MI means. And I think you can get away with a lot of lingo and not really have to stop and describe it. But if you do have something that's complicated, it's good to have a Jane Rizzoli there, standing next to you, saying, "What the hell does that mean?"
That is excellent. And again, that's another way where how you made your books accessible to a non-medical person like myself without shoving it in my face, you know, like with a footnote
or
a glossary or something like that. You're Jane, you know, you have Rizzoli there going, "What?" And asking the follow-up questions, you know, and stuff like that. Like, you know, just how hard is it to get somebody's eyeballs out?
Right, I know.
I assume that's actually probably a more complicated procedure than it might seem to be.
Well, it depends how elegant you want to be. I mean, I cite a true case that happened in Texas of a man who started off being very elegant, and as the murders went on, he got more and more crude. I think he just lost control of his his impulses. But no, it's a delicate operation, and it helps if the person's already dead. So that's really why I made it clear that this was a post-mortem excision. Yeah.
I was going to say I probably actually should have asked you if it was post or anti-mortem before.
Yeah.
That is such a fascinating setup for a book. So how many books are there in the series again?
There are 12 books in the series, and it's funny, it did not start off as a series. It started off as a standalone book. I wrote The Surgeon, published in 2001, and that was supposed to be a one-off novel. Jane Rizzoli was not going to be a main character. She was a minor character in that particular story, and it was about a serial killer who uses medical tests to choose his victims. He gets blood from doctor's offices or medical clinics, and he works in a lab, and there's something about blood tests that makes him decide to choose a particular victim. So anyway, it started off as a medical thriller, ended up as a crime novel, and Jane Rizzoli, who was, as I said, a minor character, was actually supposed to die in that novel. She was I had her death scene all planned out, and I got to yes, I know. I realized I liked her too much. She was really not a very likable person, but I still got attached to Jane. So I wrote a second book. And the second book introduced Maura Iles as a medical examiner and got interested in her. And I wrote a third book to find out what happens to Maura. So all of a sudden I had a series, and it was never planned out, which is how most of my books go. They're never planned out.
And a question I always ask of writers who have series novels like yours is, where's a good place to jump in?
For a reader to jump in, they can jump in any place. I try to give enough backstory so that every book is a standalone in itself. I mean, every book solves a crime in itself. But if you really want to see the development of Jane and Maura and their friendship, and how Jane marries and has a child, and you really should probably start with The Surgeon, which was number one.
Okay, and that makes it a richer experience as you get more invested in the characters, and you can go, all the way back to their origin stories. But for someone like, if someone wanted to go out and pick up I Know a Secret tomorrow, they're going to understand the characters and their relationship.
Yeah, I think they will. It'll still be fun, but I think what they will miss out is some of the backstory on the personal lives of Jane and Maura. Because when you get to I Know a Secret, you find out that Maura is struggling with the romantic. She has to make a choice in her love life. She's had an unhappy love affair with a Catholic priest for about 8 books now. it's gone on a while. So she's going to have to make a choice here. And you'll find out that Jane's mother is also facing a very tough romantic choice. But if you really want to see where these things started, you'd have to go back to earlier in the series.
And I honestly can't remember right now where I jumped in, but it was the same thing. I came across one of your books. And, of course, I loved it because they're fabulous. And I did go back. I get, if I really like a series and I start getting invested when I'm waiting for the new book, I'll go back and pick up, and pick up some of the, and pick up the older books and start back in. So I agree with you. I agree with you completely. And is that hard for you as the series goes on to keeping the books to be a unit, a self-contained unit without repeating yourself too much?
Well, I think the hard part is every new book, I know that there are going to be a brand new set of readers who've never read the earlier books. So yeah. I don't want them to feel like they're left behind. I want them to feel like the one book they're picking up is a universe in itself. I do have to do some background stuff. I do have to reintroduce people who've been in books before, and I have to reintroduce what the relationships are between everybody. But that is a challenge with having a long running series. Is you have these backstories. You have all these people who are in this character's universe, and you want to make sure that everybody understands what they mean to Jane, what they mean to Maura, what this priest means to Maura, for instance. He actually only pops into the book maybe a third of the way through I Know a Secret, but when he comes in, it's of great significance to Maura that he's back in her life, and you may not appreciate that unless you've seen the trauma she's gone through in the past with him.
Well, and I find it, too, sometimes with female lead characters, the I think the romantic element is very important. You know, Jack Reacher, he goes into town, he gets involved with someone who ends up being at the center of this incredible mayhem, and then he leaves town.
Right, right.
But I find it with female characters that it's more compelling when they have, when you kind of drag the baggage of their life through book after book after book.
Well, it's like real life. I mean, we do. We drag our baggage through with us for the whole of our lives. And if you're writing about people who you want to feel real or who could be your friend, you accept them with everything that they've dragged it along with them. And it's also what I think keeps readers coming back to Jane and Maura. They want to know what happens to them next. They want to know if they become happy and if this love affair is going to work out. And it's probably the number one reason that people do come back to the series is they want to know what happens. And the most communication I get about the series, it seems to be all surrounding Maura and the priest. That's what I hear most about. What's going to happen with Father Daniel Brophy? And it's funny, they don't care about the mystery. They want to know about Father Daniel Brophy.
Yeah, they don't want to know about how hard it is to get eyes out of the body. They want to know about Father Daniel.
That's right. That's trivial. That's trivial stuff. But the love affair, that's really important.
And when you get communications from readers, do they ever surprise you? Just in like maybe an interpretation that you didn't expect or something along that line?
Well, you know, I am often surprised. I guess the number one thing I'm surprised by is how I think I put these clues in, and I get people writing me and saying, what happened? I didn't get this. I didn't get who the killer was. And I thought, how could you not get that? so a lot of people who just it kind of went over their heads, and that surprises me. But I admit that when I write, I'm writing for a reader I think is really, really clever, who I'm trying to outsmart. And it's hard to outsmart a good mystery reader. They pay attention to everything. So I feel like I'm in a game of wits. I'm in a game of wits with the smartest readers. But it does mean that you leave some readers behind. that's just how it is.
And I will agree with you on that, because when I read books like these, you know, it's kind of like, wait, was that a clue? Was that a clue?
Right, right.
And sometimes what I think is a clue, you're probably just going, no, that was a blue handkerchief. You know,
right.
Misdirection
is so important. And, you know, I'm always trying to do that. I sort of feel like in this book, I Know a Secret, there's a lot of misdirection, because I didn't know the mystery myself until I finished the first draft. I didn't know what the answer was. Yeah, it's
isn't that awesome?
I don't know
when that happens.
Guy. It is awesome, and the truth is, I think for maybe half of my books, I don't know who the villain is until over the halfway mark. I figure if I'm surprised, the readers will be surprised as well.
And I didn't even know it. In my first book, I was using the Tess Garrison method, because I had no idea that the guy that was at that first meeting that I just kind of threw in there turned out to be the killer. Who knew?
Yeah,
he was
isn't
just
it
sitting
great?
There drinking, he was sitting there drinking coffee, and it turns out he was the killer the whole time.
it's great when you unwittingly place the gun on the mantelpiece, and then somebody uses it like 20 chapters later. Go ahead.
No, please. Again, go ahead. We have that little bit of a lag, so please, go ahead.
I think that as writers, we plant clues all the time that we're not really aware of. And it's only when we think back on it later on in the novel, you think, oh, wait, I put that tool in there. It's already there. Let's use it. And you just never know, you know, when it's going to become useful.
Absolutely. And that reminds me, too, when we were just talking about misdirection and that type of thing, an interview with Stephen King where he was talking about his beta readers. And he said one of his readers came back with this asking these very insightful questions about why the girl's dress was green, you know, positing this incredibly ornate explanation. And King says, he goes, I like green.
Well, you know, the other thing I've found from readers' letters, and you probably hear this too, is how easily offended readers are by things that you don't even think about.
like what? Give me an example.
I had a confrontation between a heroine and a Doberman Pinscher, I think it was, or maybe it was a pit bull or something. And mm-hmm. this was somebody who was really, really attached to Dobermans or pit bulls and got really mad at
me. No.
She said, why, they're really nice dogs. And I said, well, I know, but if I put a Chihuahua and nobody would believe that it was a threat.
You have never met my Chihuahuas.
So, yeah, and you get, the surgeon I had, my villain was a medical, he's a blood technologist. He's a technician mm-hmm. in a laboratory, and he's a bad guy. And I got a letter from a very, very angry lab person who said, what makes you think that we would kill people? And I thought, I'm not thinking you're killing somebody. It's my character. It's just a fictional
Precisely.
Character. So, yes. So, yeah, people get upset. I mean, and you also get a lot of letters about language. Oh, a lot of people hate four-letter words, and I understand that. But then you're talking about cops, and I don't think cops are very shy about using four-letter words. So,
and that goes back to that tang of authenticity. It has to, in particular, the discussion I was having with Agent Janet Reed, I was having the discussion about, it was the show The Wire.
Uh-huh.
And she was saying, obviously she knows it's drama, she knows it's fiction, but by the time she was done watching it, she believed that that's what street life was like.
Uh-huh.
And
yeah.
It was because the language was so rich. I mean, it was foul, but it was so rich in how the language was used that's what carried her along, carried her along in the story. So I agree with you on that one. There are some people that you're not even allowed one four-letter word.
Right. And, when you're dealing with, especially with Bostonians, oh my gosh, if you just stand on a street corner in Boston, oh, the words you hear. I mean, I try to tone it down a lot, but even so, it's going to offend somebody. Yeah.
Well, it's the same way with lawyers. You've obviously never been back in chambers when we're talking to the judge, type of thing, especially when it's a place where everybody really knows each other really well. Yeah,
I am always. That's funny because I always imagine you being very, very polite and proper back there. But I guess it's not true, huh?
I watched a friend of mine, and he pointed his finger at the judge and was tapping it on the desk, going, "You are full of shit."
Oh my God! Really?
Because we'd all known each other for 10 years, and it was that's the type of thing that goes on. So, we are giving you're giving the people, readers like me, a little behind the scenes tour back in the autopsy room and everything, and I don't have to scrub out or anything like that to see it. And I'm doing the same thing. I'm a little bit more of what really happens in a courtroom, despite what you actually see. And that's part of the fun of these technical thrillers.
Well, my agent told me something years ago that I've always taken to heart, and she said, readers want to know secrets. They want to know what they're not allowed to know. And if you can open the door and show them technical information that is something that's new to them, they're all fascinated by it. So, whether I show how doctors work or you show how lawyers work, and I've often said, if there's an airplane mechanic out there who can write, we'll be interested in that. We want to know what it's like to work on a giant aircraft. The secrets are what we all want to know, but we want to make sure that what you're telling us is true and it's accurate.
And that's actually an excellent way to put it, that readers want to know secrets. That is that's actually one I'm going to remember. Thank you for that.
And it doesn't matter what secrets you know. I mean, I think we would all love to know what school teachers really think about in their break room or what they talk about in the break room.
I'm not sure I do. That might be a little bit too scary.
I have a feeling I know what they're talking about.
Now, even with your qualifications, do you find that you still have to do research for some of your books?
Oh, yes, absolutely. It depends on the book. For instance, with I Know a Secret, I did quite a bit of research on false memory syndrome. I thought that was really important to the story. And I did quite a bit of research on the satanic ritual abuse panic that happened in the late 1980s, early 90s, which was, it really gripped the nation because we had so many trials going on and so many innocent people who were thrown in jail awaiting trial, and that became a pretty important part of the plot as well. And then there's sometimes I have to do technical research, especially I always go back to the book Gravity because that took me 2 years of research with NASA. So it's a matter of how deeply do you want to get into it, how important is it to your story, and what is your access to people who can actually tell you the truth.
And that was my next question is, you know, have you developed kind of a circle of people you can go to and call when you have some sort of, a, you know, esoteric question? It's like somebody you can call to say, okay, I have to shoot a guy with arrows.
Well, for pathology, I do have, I mean, I do have contacts who are forensic pathologists when it comes to firearms. And I'm very skittish about firearms because I know people who know anything about guns are very quick to write you and say you made a mistake.
So
I go to my son is the foremost, foremost expert on firearms I can talk to. But I still sometimes just fall back with a really weaselly, she drew her weapon. That's it. You know, I don't want to be specific.
When in doubt.
Yeah, just say weapon. But a lot of times you have to just gird your loins and pick up the phone and call somebody. And it's the scariest thing you will do is to pick up the phone and call a stranger who's an expert and ask him for advice. By nature, I don't like to ask for favors. But what I've found is that people love to talk about their professions. They want to help you. They want to tell you, you know, what they know. And I haven't had much trouble getting access.
Well, and too, if Tess Gerritsen called me to ask me some question about what went on in judges' chambers, I would be thrilled to talk with you about it because people love your books. They love your books. They love your characters. And you get to feel like you're a little tiny part of it. I'm sure when someone gives you information, they're like, I told her that.
Yeah, except that they sometimes want to be anonymous. That's okay.
Well, I was talking to Jonathan Mayberry, and as subjects do with him, it turns to spaceships. And he was talking about, you know, if a spaceship crashed, he'd be the first one to want to see it. And I said, you know, you'd already know who you'd call to get the tour. And he's like, as a matter of fact, I do. So there's that importance of developing that professional network. Do people call you? Do writers call you and ask you questions about the medical portion?
No, they don't. I think most writers have their own sources, and certainly about medicine. If they don't, they should cultivate them. And you know, I always tell people that you don't necessarily have to go to a doctor for this material. You can go to a nurse. Nurses know an awful lot. They know the language, and if they don't know the language, they can find out. So, I think a good ER or OR nurse can tell you a lot.
That's actually an excellent idea and very, very interesting because, nurses have seen it all.
Yeah. And they've actually been, I mean, they're on the front lines. And they also, they know the medical terminology. And if they don't, they know where to find it in a dictionary. So I would not overlook a nurse for that expertise.
So I Know a Secret came out in August.
Mm-hmm.
And it looks like it's getting great reviews. I'm looking at right now, and it's, Rizzoli and Isles, what more could you want? I've been in love with Tess Gerritsen since the very first Rizzoli and Isles posted 2 days ago. And I have to say I agree with that reader. Are you working on anything now?
I'm working on something that is totally different, and I'm afraid I'm worried about how it's going to be accepted because it's so different. It's a ghost story. And it's it's about a woman who rents a sea captain's house in Maine, and the sea captain, who's long deceased, is still there, and they fall in love, except that over time she begins to find out that every woman who's lived in this house has died in the house. So she's wondering if she's fallen in love with a ghost or a demon, and, you know, it's one of these is it supernatural or is it not supernatural kind of questions. But it's been a lot of fun to write.
What prompted you to go off in that direction?
Well, I had written a screenplay years and years ago about that situation. It was a very erotic thriller, and then I put it aside and hadn't thought about it. And maybe last year, 2 years, I pulled it out and I thought, hey, this would make a great novel. And that's what I'm turning a screenplay into a novel is what I'm doing.
That sounds absolutely fascinating. When you get farther along with it and it sees the light of day, I would love to have you back to talk about it, because I definitely want to read that. It sounds fascinating.
Yeah, the reason I'm a little nervous is that it is very sexy, and I mean, we are talking about a lover, right? Who just happens to be dead, it's quite a change for me, but there is crime involved, so it still goes along the thriller line, the thriller aspect that I think will work.
Well, good. There had darn well better be a crime in there. We have expectations here.
I know, somebody has to die, right?
No, seriously, I would love to have you back again in the future to talk more about this. This has been absolutely fascinating.
Well, great. I'd love to.
Okay, and at this, I'll say good evening to you. I'll remind everybody that I Know a Secret is available via Amazon and all of your other assorted and sundry booksellers. And check it out. I think it's one of the best Rizzoli and Isles books yet.
Well, thank you very much, Terry.
All right. And enjoy your visit with your family. And I look forward to talking to you again in the future.
Sure thing. Okay. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye. And I'll tell everyone that the Blue Plate Special is a copyrighted podcast solely owned by Authors on the Air Global Radio. You can check us out on Facebook and see who's going to be on the menu next week. I am taking a hiatus over the Thanksgiving holiday, and then we're going to come back in the first week of December to talk about, we're going to be talking with some nonfiction writers about everything from music to comic books. The Saturday after Thanksgiving, I'm going to be appearing with several other quality writers, including Eric Pruitt, Don Bruns, etc., at Noir in the Bar in Tampa. And this weekend, we're going to be at the Miami Book Fair. If you happen to see us, please stop and say hi. And with that, I'll say goodnight to everyone, and thank you again.